From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Afghan leaders on a U.S. visit to revitalize relations. Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu about to form a new government. The 2016 U.S. presidential election gets its first official candidate. Homeless women find hope on L.A.'s Skid Row. These and other stories coming up. I'm Ray Kugel. Afghanistan's President Ashraf Ghani and Chief Executive Abdullah Abdullah held talks with top U.S. officials at the presidential retreat in Camp David, Maryland, Monday. Their discussions were aimed at improving bilateral relations that have been strained by almost 14 years of war. VOA's Pam Dawkins reports.
Flanked by U.S. and Afghan flags, U.S. Secretary of State Kerry, Defense Secretary Carter, Afghan President Ghani, and his Chief Executive Abdullah each made opening remarks and took questions. Each official wore a dark suit but no tie. They smiled at each other and seemed to be at ease. They spoke in a converted airplane hangar at the heavily secure Camp David site. U.S. officials announced several deliverables from today's talks at the Pentagon and Camp David. Secretary Carter said the Defense Department intends to seek funding for Afghan forces to sustain 352,000 personnel through 2017. He said Afghan and coalition military commanders have recommended this size force to ensure security gains that have been made are lasting. He also announced the reinstatement of a U.S.-Afghanistan Security Consultative Forum. Secretary Kerry announced a new initiative, a plan to create a new development partnership aligned with the unity government's reform agenda. He said this initiative reflects the strategic importance of the U.S.-Afghan relationship and recognizes a new era of cooperation between the two governments. He said the partnership will promote Afghan self-reliance by using up to $800 million in U.S. aid to incentivize and measure Afghan-led reform and development activities and strengthen Afghan institutions. Kerry, Ghani, and Carter were asked about any possible slowdown in the U.S. current plans for withdrawal from Afghanistan in order to address ongoing Afghan security concerns. They declined to say whether the U.S. would move forward with a slow timeline, saying the issue would be discussed during Tuesday's talks with President Obama. Both Ghani and Abdullah repeatedly thanked the U.S. for its continued support and vowed to work on strengthening their government.
VOA's State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins. Earlier Monday, Mr. Ghani visited U.S. Defense Headquarters at the Pentagon near Washington to thank U.S. troops for their sacrifice in his country. VOA's Carla Babb has details.
Speaking in the center courtyard of the five-sided U.S. military headquarters, President Ashraf Ghani paid tribute to the more than 2,000 U.S. service members who have died in Afghanistan since 2001 and the more than 850,000 who served there during the past 14 years. He also said the threat of terrorism would never defeat Afghans.
And in this endeavor, our partnership with the United States is foundational because we will be the first line of defense for freedom globally.
If that first line does not hold, the Pentagon knows all too well what could happen. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter.
In this courtyard, we're also reminded why they went to Afghanistan in the first place. Because just beyond these walls stands a memorial honoring all those who perished when the Pentagon was attacked on that bright, fateful day in 2001.
U.S. troops entered Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks to root out al-Qaeda terrorists being harbored by the Taliban. Mr. Ghani, however, focused on more than just the fighting and military training of the U.S. forces. He thanked them for building schools, dams, and roads that have helped Afghanistan make social and economic improvements. A touching moment came when President Ghani directly addressed 9-year-old Reese Larson, whose father is serving in Afghanistan.
Reese, I have greetings to you from 3 million young Afghan girls who are attending school today. 14 years ago, there were exactly none. So each one of them wants to entertain the hopes that you do. And your dad is making this possible.
Carla Babb, VOA News, the Pentagon.
Military forces aligned with Libya's internationally recognized government shot down a warplane Monday flown by airmen linked to the rival Tripoli-based government allied with Islamist militias. Libya's Tobruk-based government said the fighter jet flown by the rival Dawn of Libya militia was shot down in western Libya after it had bombed targets in the western city of Zintan, supportive of the elected government. A Tobruk spokesman said the pilot was killed. Tunisia's prime minister fired five police commanders on Monday in the wake of last week's terrorist assault in Tunis and the country's national museum that left 21 people dead, all but one of them foreign tourists. Tunisian authorities say guards assigned to provide security at the museum and the adjacent parliament complex were having coffee at the time two militants gunned down the tourists. They included visitors from Japan, Poland, Italy, and Spain, who had just gotten off buses at the museum. Two gunmen were killed by security forces. A third is still on the loose. Forces loyal to Yemen's Houthi rebel group appear to have been stopped Monday in their drive south towards the southern capital of Aden. Houthi forces succeeded earlier in taking control of security installations in Taiz, the country's third largest city. Edward Uranian has more.
Residents of Yemen's third largest city, Taiz, jeered a convoy of Houthi rebel fighters Monday outside a special forces base, demanding they withdraw. The rebels appeared to consolidate their grip on Taiz, but were pushed back as they tried to advance further south. A tribal fighter battling the Houthi forces trying to punch through to Aden insisted he and his men would sooner die than allow the Houthis to enter the south of the country. He says the Houthi enemies have incurred losses along with his own men, but he does not consider this to be a loss, since his men are defending their land, their country, the legal government, and nationalistic principles. Acting Yemeni Foreign Minister Riyad Yassin says his country is calling on Gulf states to deploy joint defense forces to stop Houthi militants from occupying further territory. He says the demand for troops has been made and the time has come to do something since the Houthis refuse to stop their advance and they do not want to enter into dialogue. He complains that they are also trying to occupy more territory while threatening protesters and arresting people. Houthi rebel leader Abdelmalek al-Houthi gave a different reason for his group's push to the south. He insists the decision to enter Taiz and other areas was not meant to threaten residents of the south, but that these areas must not be allowed to fall under the control of Al-Qaeda, Islamic State militants, or their allies, who are guilty of committing the most awful crimes. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
With militants in the Middle East attacking members of other faiths and destroying museum pieces considered un-Islamic, a heated debate is underway in America over the religious roots of their actions. VOA's Jerome Sokolowski has details.
It was called the iconoclastic fury when 16th century Protestants destroyed statues considered to be idolatrous. Militants in Iraq have been destroying priceless treasures deemed to be un-Islamic, giving many the sense of living in a time warp.
This is not 1015, this is 2015. And as I speak, people are being crucified, people are being burned alive, they're being beheaded.
Lindsey Graham of South Carolina led a Senate hearing focused on the Islamic State militant group. Its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, claims to be caliph of a re-established medieval Muslim empire.
Senator, on behalf of the American Center for Law and Justice,
conservative Christian activist Jay Sekulow believes the Islamic claim is authentic.
That's what they call themselves. They call themselves the caliphate. Caliph Ibrahim believes he's the leader of worldwide Islam. So whatever we want to call him, in one sense, is irrelevant because that's who they are.
As lawmakers grapple with how to respond to the militant groups, there's a wider debate over whether these extremists should be seen as part of Islam or as a deviation from the faith.
from my point of view, what you've got is the hijacking of religion.
Islamic studies professor John Esposito says the injunction in the Quran to slay the unbelievers wherever you find them is being taken out of context.
When that scripture was uttered, it had nothing to do with Christians and Jews at that point. It had to do with pagan Meccans who were at that point persecuting Muslims. And God in the Quran was saying to them, if they're fighting you, you have a right to fight back.
Some commentators argue that Islam needs a Protestant-like reformation that rejects the traditional interpretation of Scripture. But Esposito says they should be careful what they wish for.
They'll say Islam needs a reformation. I sometimes say to some of my Muslim friends, what they're really saying then is genocide ought to take place, or close to it. Because we think of the Reformation as the Enlightenment, and we forget the Hundred Years' Wars.
European history certainly had its share of sectarian conflicts. Because one thing that cuts across the boundaries of time and faith, Esposito says, is the use of religion to legitimate political power and warfare. Jerome Sokolovsky, VOA News, Washington.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu received enough of an endorsement from the country's political parties and the newly elected parliament to be named today to form the next coalition government. VOA's Scott Bob reports.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is on course to form Israel's next government after receiving support from parties that together won a majority of the 120 seats in the newly elected parliament. Israeli President Reuven Rivlin made the announcement Monday on the second day of his consultations with the parties elected to the parliament, or Knesset. He says 61 Knesset members have requested Mr. Netanyahu be the one to try to form the new government. Scott Bob, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Mr. Netanyahu Monday said he regretted issuing a warning to his supporters during the country's elections last week that Arab voters were heading to the polls in droves. At an event at the prime minister's residence in Jerusalem Monday, he told members of the Arab community he recognizes the comment hurt Israeli Arabs and that it was not his intention to do so. Mr. Netanyahu says he sees himself as representing all Israeli citizens without differentiating between religions, races, and sex.
Nigeria decides 2015, the final hours of the presidential campaign for Nigeria. What happens there matters throughout Africa. VOA News is ready with the largest team of international journalists in Nigeria and surrounding countries. Turn to Voice of America for the facts. Nigeria decides 2015 on radio with Daybreak Africa, Africa News Tonight, and Nightline Africa. On television with Africa 54 and Straight Talk Africa. On the web at voanews.com. Special coverage of Nigeria presidential election voting begins this Saturday, with results as the votes are counted, and on the web to show you where the counting stands and where the votes are coming from. Nigeria decides 2015. A commitment to Africa from Voice of America.
Ukraine again accused pro-Russian separatists of violating the ceasefire agreement the two sides signed last month, saying the rebels fired rockets and artillery at Ukrainian military positions in eastern Ukraine. A Ukrainian military spokesman says six soldiers were wounded in fighting over the previous 24 hours. NATO officials and European monitors have confirmed the renewed fighting. The Prime Minister of Greece, Alexis Tsipras, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel held talks Monday in Berlin aimed at bridging sharp differences over Greece's economic future. Mr. Tsipras is seeking short-term financial aid from the European Union in order to service its $270 billion debt to European creditors in the coming months and to keep Athens from falling out of the 19-member Eurozone. Germany and other creditors are demanding that Greek leaders first make and enforce tough spending cuts and implement wide-ranging reforms in exchange for more bailout money. The trial of a U.S. Marine accused of killing a transgender Philippine national last October is underway. The trial is also a test of the visiting forces agreement between the United States and the Philippines. Simone Orendine reports from Manila.
The women's rights group Gabriella says it is closely monitoring the trial of Private First Class Joseph Scott Pemberton. The group wants a conviction of Pemberton, who is charged with murder for the death of Jennifer, formerly Jeffrey, Laude. Witnesses found Laude's body in the hotel bathroom in Olongapo City in Subic Bay after they last saw Laude with Pemberton on October 11th. Gabriella Secretary General John Salvador says there are several pressures on the case. She says the Laude family should not be sweet-talked into a settlement and should seek a murder conviction. Salvador says getting a conviction is just one step, but the real struggle will be and has been in the question of custody over the 19-year-old Pemberton.
We hope that instead of trying to protect the interests of Pemberton as an American citizen covered by the Visiting Forces Agreement, both the Philippine and American governments would take the interest of justice for Jennifer Laude at the prime consideration.
Nationalists and rights advocacy groups have been vocal against a provision in the VFA saying the United States maintains custody of an American service person accused of a crime in the Philippines throughout the legal proceedings. The terms, however, say the Philippines has criminal jurisdiction over such cases. Pemberton is in U.S. custody at a facility inside the Philippine military's main headquarters in Metro Manila. Simone Orendain for VOA News, Manila.
Thousands of mourners have gathered outside the Prime Minister's official residence in Singapore to lay flowers and pay their respects to the country's founder, Lee Kuan Yew, who died Monday at the age of 91. Kate Lamb looks at how the Singaporean statesman is being remembered by world leaders.
Singapore's founding father is credited with the transformation of a former tropical colonial outpost into an ultra-modern global finance and trade hub. Prioritizing clean and efficient governance, pro-business policies and social order, sometimes at the expense of democratic freedoms, Lee is revered for his results. A week of official mourning has been declared in Singapore, and a state funeral will be held on March 29. Kate Lamb, Jakarta.
President Obama is calling for free and fair elections in Nigeria this Saturday and for Nigerians to reject the violence that has marred the country's previous polls. In a video released Monday by the U.S. Embassy in Abuja, he said successful elections are key to stopping insurgent group Boko Haram and allowing more than 1 million displaced Nigerians to return to their homes. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan is running for re-election against former military ruler Muhammadu Buhari. U.S. officials say there is no indication that a data breach led to Islamic State's posting on the Internet what it says are the names, addresses, and photographs of 100 U.S. military personnel that had encouraged its supporters in the United States to kill. A group calling itself the Islamic State Hacking Division said Sunday the details of the service members who it claims were involved in U.S. airstrikes against Islamic State in Iraq and Syria came from government servers and databases. The race for the U.S. presidency in 2016 now has its first official candidate. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas officially announced he's running on Monday. Senator Cruz will be part of what's expected to be a large field of Republican White House contenders. Here's VOA's Jim Malone.
Ted Cruz made his presidential announcement Monday at the nation's largest Christian university, Liberty University, in Lynchburg, Virginia.
I believe in the power of millions of courageous conservatives rising up to reignite the promise of America. And that is why today I am announcing that I'm running for president of the United States.
Cruz said as president he would repeal President Barack Obama's health care law and abolish the Internal Revenue Service, the government's tax-collecting agency. On foreign policy, Cruz told the crowd that as president he would, in his words, stand unapologetically with the nation of Israel, and he vowed to wage an aggressive military campaign against the Islamic State militant group.
Imagine a president who says we will stand up and defeat radical Islamic terrorism. and we will call it by its name.
Cruz was one of 47 Senate Republicans who signed an open letter to Iran's leaders warning that any nuclear deal reached with the Obama administration could be undone by a future president. Cruz was elected to the Senate in 2012 and quickly established himself as a favorite of Tea Party conservatives. Cruz led a 21-hour filibuster on the Senate floor in 2013 to try to defund the health care law known as Obamacare. A few weeks later, he was also a leader of the 16-day partial government shutdown over the health care law that hurt the Republican Party's national image. Cruz hopes his early announcement will give him a boost in public opinion polls, where he lags in a crowded Republican field that is likely to include former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, and fellow Senators Rand Paul of Kentucky, Marco Rubio of Florida, and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. At this early stage, the Republican race is wide open, says University of Virginia analyst Larry Sabato.
You realize that it's an unformed field. It's obvious from every survey that's been done that the Republican faithful are completely undecided. There is no front runner. The weakness of Jeb Bush in the polls, I think, is notable. He's yet to break 20 in any of the major national polls, and he's well behind in some of the key state polls.
Cruz hopes to appeal first and foremost to Tea Party conservatives and evangelical Christian voters, two key blocks within the Republican Party. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
An area called Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles, California, has one of the highest concentrations of homeless people in the United States. But for the homeless and helpless, there are many social services to be found. Elizabeth Lee tells us about one such organization focused on helping homeless women through creative means.
Skid Row is like no other place in Los Angeles. The homeless congregate on the sidewalks for blocks all times of day.
It's a place that where everybody is dumped, you know. And if you don't ask for help, you're not going to get help.
Yolanda Waters' life now as a barista is nothing like what it was just a couple of years ago. She was homeless and ended up on Skid Row.
For people that are looking at you like you're nothing, treating you like you ain't worth nothing, that's the hard part.
In the middle of Skid Row, Waters found a place that taught her she is worth something. The Downtown Women's Center, among many of its services, gives homeless women job skills and helps them find work. To prepare for the real world, homeless women receive job training at the center's boutique and cafe and through craft-making workshops. The women learn to create different items, from candles and greeting cards to ornaments. The center's Joe Altipeter says the program teaches them to arrive on time, complete a project, and work in a group.
Rebuilding self-esteem, developing relationships with individuals, you know, chronic homelessness when you're living on the streets, you become isolated. So this is an opportunity to really deal with those issues.
He says women make up a quarter of the 58,000 homeless people in Los Angeles. The high cost of housing is one factor. Women who already live on the edge of poverty are more at risk of being homeless. Many who end up on the streets struggle with mental illness and past trauma, such as domestic violence. At the center, women receive counseling, health care, and support.
They come into the workshops. They might not have a really great community of friends or a support network, but they're entering this safe and supportive environment which offers that for them.
The women's crafts are sold at the Downtown Women's Center and at one high-end department store in L.A. The handmade items all have labels that say made by DWC. Kathy Sudo of Bloomingdale's Century City says sales have been so successful that she hopes these items will expand to other stores.
We have been very pleasantly surprised. It is something I'm now working to get the other five Bloomingdale stores in the Los Angeles market to start carrying as part of their assortment.
For Yolanda Waters, she tried her hand at crafts and did not love it. Instead, she discovered a knack for making coffee and other drinks at the cafe. After training here, she was offered a job. Now with a paycheck, she has an apartment and a reason to get up in the morning.
It feels unreal. And because sometimes I think when I wake up that, you know, is it real? Do I have this real job, a real job that I really love?
Water says she wants homeless women to know there is hope and a place on Skid Row where they are welcomed. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. Follow us 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
This is Today in History. On March 24th, 1707, the Acts of Union was signed, officially uniting the kingdoms of England and Scotland and creating Great Britain. In 1832, a Hiram, Ohio mob tarred and feathered Mormon leader Joseph Smith. Smith survived the attack. The reason for the violence is disputed, but many believe it was due to controversies surrounding a romance that Smith had with a local woman. In 1934, the United States Congress passed the Tidings-McDuffie Act, mapping out a process by which the Philippines would become an independent nation. In 1958, rock and roll pioneer Elvis Presley was inducted into the U.S. Army. On this day in 1976, the president of Argentina, Isabel Perón, was deposed by the country's military in a bloodless coup. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On March 24th, nations around the globe will observe World Tuberculosis Day, commemorating Dr. Robert Koch's 1882 discovery of Mycobacterium tuberculosis, the bacteria that caused the disease. The observance is designed to build public awareness about the global epidemic of tuberculosis. TB is the second leading cause of death from infectious diseases worldwide, infecting almost 9 million people and killing some 1.3 million. Prior to the advent of antibiotics in the 1940s, tuberculosis, or TB, was one of the most feared diseases around. The majority of TB deaths occur in the developing world, where the disease is closely linked to poverty, marginalized and vulnerable populations, substandard housing, and poor nutrition. The fight to eliminate TB has seen tremendous progress over the past quarter century, with a 45% decline in mortality since 1990 and the emergence of new technologies, such as fast-acting diagnostics for use in low- and middle-income countries, and which was developed with funding from the U.S. government, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and the World Health Organization. Despite the availability of effective treatment for many decades, TB remains a major global health problem. Today, TB's global incidence rate is falling slowly. Five of the six WHO regions of the world are on track to meet the UN Millennium Development Goal of halving TB prevalence and deaths by the end of 2015. The United States is committed to fighting TB. In focusing our efforts in countries where the burden of TB is highest, we support programs that save lives and foster a more secure world. Across the federal government, we have made this fight a priority. We are the first and largest single contributor to the Global Fund to Fight HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, having donated over $5 billion to the Global Fund since its inception in 2002. The United States continues to partner with the World Health Organization, or WHO, the Stop TB Partnership, and the Global Drug Facility, all of which provide important support for TB control activities worldwide. While these developments are encouraging, the fight to eliminate TB requires continued strong engagement and commitment by governments and communities, public and private health care providers, people in affected communities, and TB patients themselves. By joining in a global commitment to stop the spread of TB, we can begin to free a new generation from an ancient affliction.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.